Osiris.
I didn't feel that I could depend on anybody. I didn't feel that I was loved. I felt very alone with my new baby. And just knowing that I had to get out of this relationship with John. And I didn't want to hear another fucking song that he wrote because he was crazy at this point. And he didn't know a good song from a bad song, and he didn't care.
Welcome to Discography, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the mamas and the papas, along with our unbelievably special guests, band biographer Richard Campbell, who's published an amazing bio, almost like a prequel really, called Gettin' Kinda Itchy, and Be Still My Beating Heart, the absolutely radiant goddess herself, Michelle Phillips, who'll be sifting through the sacred transmissions issued forth from her younger self and rating them all, every last LP and single, from 0 to 5 stars. This is part 4 of an epic new series called From a 16-Hour Interview, called Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, in which Michelle looks back with shockingly raw candor at a life exquisitely well-lived. In part 4, Michelle reveals a blow-by-blow of how she wound up falling in love with Mamas and Papas producer Lou Adler while she was pregnant with China, the true story behind how she brought Dream a Little Dream to the band, and her contemptuous dismissal of their 4th album, The Papas and the Mamas, recorded while the band fell to pieces. Before we kick things off, just a quick word from Michelle.
Hey, lads and ladies. Michelle Phillips here from the Mamas and the Papas. If you're like me and you want it all, then why in the world would you settle for a trimmed down version of my interview? To get access to the extended director's cut of this and all future episodes, just join Discography's Patreon. Dave Gebro's been singing for his supper for over 2 years now. The guy puts out several shows a week, and it's just the best music podcast of all time. You're not going to want to miss a single minute of it. Patreon.com/Discography. Do it.
If you're a Michelle Phillips and Mamas and the Papas super fan like me, you'll want to turn this free version off right now and opt for the ultimate director's cut of this episode on our Patreon page, which features a whopping 47 additional minutes of essential material. And you can find it in our Patreon record shop for mere pennies at patreon.com/discography/shop. Or just subscribe for the complete versions of all our shows. Even if you're on the fence, just head over there, because it's finally free to become a basic member. I'm going to take this opportunity now to give a shout out to brand new Patreon member Tyler Davis, an 18-year-old young man with great taste and a soft spot for the Mamas and the Papas, who literally canceled his cable TV and subscribed to Discography at the Brigadier General tier, which is $40 a month. Trust me, if he can find a way, so can you. Tyler, I love you, and you are seriously my hero. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discography is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore an artist or band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes even bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider rating the Strawberry Alarm Clock, the Lemon Twigs, and the three surviving Dedrick siblings rating everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, the Free Design. Not to mention tons more Michelle Phillips, so don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then! Phase 2, The Chandelier Blows Its Final Bulbs. 1967 to 1968. So sessions for album 4 begin, and I'm curious if you agree with John's assessment that, and I quote, "The distance among the four of us was clear during the sessions, which were often tense and unsatisfying."
Well, Cass was very sick and had to have a nurse with her at the sessions. I didn't feel that we had anything to record.
I'm just curious, because the sessions began previous to this, I believe, but were you feeling a distance from the gang as well? I mean, I'm guessing I know the answer to this question, because I think you already answered it by saying you thought the whole venture was through anyway.
You know, you have to understand how important it was that we lived together at the beginning. When you live together, you're always rehearsing, or you're always writing, or you're always laughing, or eating, or sleeping, but you did it together. And now here we are, so separated from each other. John and I are really in our own world. We're having these huge parties, and we're meeting all of Hollywood, and Cass has got her own group of horrible people that she hung out with. Danny was just living in Mary Astor's old house, and he was drinking himself into a snit.
But that whole story is, I mean, that is almost the saddest, because if what I've collected in my research, if this is true, then he needed people around, but then he didn't want to be around them. So he actually rented a different house, kept the party going at his house, and relocated.
I don't know. I've never heard that before. But it doesn't sound unrealistic. When Denny asked me if I wanted to go back to the Virgin Islands with him and just forget the whole thing, forget John, forget Cass, forget the mamas and the papas, we'll just go back to the Virgin Islands, you and I. You know, I said, no. And that's not what you want either, Denny. And you're not going to throw away everything that you've ever wanted in your life, which was to be a successful singer, musician, writer, whatever. And he went back to the Virgin Islands. I can't put everything into a real box about the time frame, because it's all kind of a messy thing in my head too, you know.
One thing that John has talked about, which sounds like this might have been kind of a hard stop for you guys, he talks about having, you know, infidelities with groupies while you were pregnant, and, you know, that becoming clear to you. And I can only imagine, I mean, you're a force of nature without any of that stuff, you know, to be confronted by that, that must have been just horrible. I can't imagine that.
Actually, after my 5th month of pregnancy, I didn't want to have sex. I'm sure there was more than you ever wanted to know.
No. I appreciate that. I mean, I don't think that's very uncommon, but were you encouraging John?
No, I didn't know that he was sleeping with Nurit. I just read it in a book.
My God, it wasn't just now when I said it to you.
Yeah. No, by now I know, but I didn't know then. And, the only odd thing was that he would take his motorcycle and leave, and then he wouldn't come back until 7 o'clock in the morning. And that should have been my first clue. But he would say things like, you know, there was this beautiful full moon, and I got off the bike and I just laid down in the ivy and I fell asleep.
And that's why there's leaves and grass all over him.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so, like, just as soon as things are going great for you guys, then, and Richard, maybe I have the order of things a little bit, you know, obfuscated, but it seems like things are going great, but the sessions are not really going well. You guys grind out about three, I think you grind out three songs and then give up. John calls a press conference in September 67 and says the group's going to be breaking up.
Here's the deal. I was 5 months pregnant when we got on the France to go to Southampton, England. And when we got there, one of the pursers said, you know, we were being asked to step aside and just go sit over there. You know, he came up to John and he said, I want you to know that Cass Elliot is going to be arrested when she gets off the ship. And we didn't even know until the next day what she was charged with. And Lou arrives in London. And who does he have with him? Jill Gibson. And I was infuriated. And when I saw that she was with Lou, I said to John, I said, she better not be coming to court with us in the morning. And he said, well, I think she is. I said, she better not. And when I got out of the car and I was headed into the courthouse, there was Jill and Luke, and they came into the courthouse and Lou looked over at me and I flipped him the bone. And he came over to me and he said, you know, Michelle, you ought to really think about what your problem is with Jill, because I just don't understand your reaction to this. He said, you better think about it. I said, okay, I'll think about it. And I went up to my room and I started to think about what Lou had said to me. Think about why you're so mean about Jill. So I went downstairs to their suite, knocked on the door, went inside. They were sharing a lovely bottle of Dom Perignon, which was in an ice bucket. And they were both sipping champagne. And I said, well, I've given it some thought, Lou. I don't want Jill Gibson traveling with us. This is business. This is not your vacation with your girlfriend. This is our business. So there you go. I don't want to see her around anymore. And as a matter of fact, Lou, I think I may be in love with you and I don't want any girls around you.
You're too much. You are just amazing. You really are. And by the way, all these, you know, we were talking before about all these different crosshatched lines of impossibly intricate relationships between the four of you. Then you got your producer who has a woman who had replaced you and she's still hanging around as if it wasn't messy enough. That's crazy. He's nuts.
I think it was very, very short-sighted of Lou Adler to bring Jill Gibson on tour with us.
Yeah. But he also had to, by this point, have seen you guys as an outfit that was inspired by fucked up thinking. Right?
Yeah. You know what? I'll tell you, I had a reason to believe that, you know, I did love Lou very much. John had already had children. He couldn't give a flying rat's ass if I was pregnant or not. But Lou, on the other hand, did. And every time something came up, he always had a gift for me and for the coming baby. And he was so excited about me having a baby that I just really fell for it. You know, I said, this is so nice. I wish Lou were my partner right now. I mean, I was crazy. I'm the first to admit that. I was on steroids or something. I was very confused about my husband not even caring about me being pregnant. And I was so happy when Lou did care. And it made me very mad when I saw him traveling with Jill Gibson on our tour.
Can I tell you what I'm seeing in my mind's eye right now that's making me very excited is a sort of cinematic retelling of the Michelle Jill thing, but it's done up as a rivalry thing where you actually do get with Lou. And then just as Jill was replacing you on the album covers, you go through all his personal pictures and paste your head on Jill's body on all of them. I would like to write and direct this film if you're interested. You know, if you were in my family and you were like the matriarch of my family, I think the way that I would see you is somebody who's brilliant at seizing opportunities. And life is really all about, I have a very close friend of mine who I speak with actually every day. And he has a phrase, moving at the speed of opportunity. You're either ready for what life gives you or you're just not ready.
That's right.
If you're not ready, it's not going to happen. You seem like you're 100% ready at all times and you flow with all the changes. And that's as admirable a trait as can be.
You know, David, I was raised by Gardner Burnett Gilliam, who was the most intelligent, progressive, funny, wonderful parent that anybody could ever ask for. What I'm trying to say is that I had such a great influence from my father. He just said, you know, basically, you never take any shit from a man. If someone ever hits you, you're out the door.
Yeah.
Even if they're verbally abusive, you're gone. My father was so smart. He said, Michelle, when you become sexually active, you have to let me know so that we can prepare you to not get pregnant. He didn't say, if you become sexually active.
Right, right.
He said, when?
So were you on the pill? I mean, were you taking the pill in the 60s?
I was a virgin in the 60s. Well,
all through the 60s.
I was certainly a virgin when he told me this. You know, I was like 12. You know, he thought 12 was the appropriate time to tell you the facts of life.
I just had the conversation with my son last night. He just turned 5.
Good for you. The younger, the better.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I felt weird talking about sex with him, so we only talked about oral.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oral. Oh. Oral sex.
Yeah, right.
You know what? My father did not discuss oral sex with me. I wonder why.
That's bizarre. I'll never forget the night my dad set me down and explained that as long as I have a warm butthole, that I'll have a way to make money, no matter what happens. That changed my life. That conversation with him changed my life. All right. So.
Well, you know what? I never had an unwanted pregnancy, and I never got addicted to drugs.
You made it through unscathed, as far as I'm concerned. I have no idea how to elegantly transition back to August 67. So I'm going to do what they used to call on Saturday Night Live, dropping the cow. When they didn't know how to end a sequence, they would literally drop an inflatable cow from the rafters. Here I am dropping the cow. Okay. August 1967, the 1230 single goes to number 20. Richard is correct here. I was incorrect. It is your last sort of classic era single.
That's a big, huge bummer for us for going to number 20. How embarrassing is that?
It doesn't matter, though, long term. It was a bummer then, but this song is as good as anything you guys ever did. You know, the winds of change is all a bunch of bullshit. In the end, this evened out is on the same level as everything else. Anyone will tell you that.
Classic John Phillips putting two songs. It's really two different songs that he melds together.
And in a way, conceptually, it closes the loop. Because think about it, you guys, you know, are kind of living on borrowed time as a band. And he is closing the loop of when you first were together and then ending it, closing that loop. It's a complete cycle now. Another in the sort of blown bulb gestures from John. But it's a great song. I don't want to go too in-depth because we'll get to it when we get to Papas and the Mamas. October 67, Glad to Be Unhappy. Yet again, I believe John being honest, but not in a direct way. Like frustration, there's no words. I get the sense of the frustration. I get it. Glad to Be Unhappy is a cover song, but he's basically, this is the end of the band, spelt out in a cover, right?
I liked it.
Oh, I love the song. I'm not saying it's not a good song. It's a great song.
He just says he thinks it's descriptive of where you were. That's the title. Glad to Be Unhappy. Like a straying baby lamb with no mama and no papa. I'm so unhappy, but I'm so glad.
To be unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a Rodgers Hart cover that to me feels as honest as anything Bob Dylan was doing at the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was part of the Rodgers and Hart special. I couldn't have picked out a Rodgers and Hart song to do. John picked them all out. I don't know. Maybe everybody from his generation knew all the tracks of Rodgers and Hart and all the songs, but I didn't know any of them.
Cass would have known them.
Yes.
This pretty much says everything. Plus, you all must have known that a song called Glad to Be Unhappy when the Summer of Love had just concluded was probably not going to be a huge hit, right?
Mm.
Couldn't have been, probably. So it's got balls.
All I know is that Lou did not want to release it as a single. And for some reason, John and Lou had kind of drifted apart as friends. And I'm not quite sure what part I played in that, but...
I'm thinking large.
Well,
yeah, maybe so.
It has to also have to do with the fact that everything blows up in London. They abort their plans. Lou couldn't have been very pleased about that. And so they're sort of picking up the pieces.
And actually, we're not doing anything. We're lifting it off the show. The only thing that we did with these three songs was create a fourth song, No Salt on Her Tail.
And that's another thing too. You're dipping back into the same well.
It's a deep, empty well.
It is, but it's still an honest, he's honest about the emptiness. And that's commendable as far as I'm concerned. It's like, you know, in Traffic, when they did John Barleycorn, Empty Pages is an incredible song about writer's block. And, you know, you can milk that emptiness. That still is valid subject matter, I believe. Anyway, I give Glad to Be Unhappy 5 stars.
I do too. I loved Glad to Be Unhappy. I didn't like No Salt on Her Tail, but I thought it was ingenious what John was doing. And I didn't even know if it was legal. And neither did Lou or John. We didn't know if you could actually pilfer a track and put new lyrics to it and make it another song.
You heard it here first, folks. This is an exclusive John Phillips invented sampling.
It's true.
The father of hip hop, John Phillips.
So jumping back in, I give it a 5 as well. Like I said a minute ago, I love the lyric. I think when you're in late 67 and you're wondering what the mamas and the papas are doing, you've had 12:30, and then they're saying, like a straying baby lamb with no mama and no papa, and they're so strong saying that, you're sort of like, what's going on? Is there a mamas and papas still? Are they breaking up? Are they still here? I mean, that's sort of, if you're reading at the time, everybody's kind of like, what's happening with them? This thing?
Yeah, you know,
is this shake up in England? What's going to happen?
Richard, you know, as a matter of fact, every time I hear that song, I cry. I do. There's something so sad.
Also, there's another noteworthy thing about it. It's the last of your singles produced in a professional studio.
Wow. Really?
Maybe there's something of that that informs an emotional response to it. Because from here on in, it's at 783, and I can only imagine the difference in vibe.
Well, you know, Lou Adler just walked out. Lou Adler walked out the door because John now was not only the writer, the performer, but now he was the engineer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was no bones how.
Let me ask you a direct pointed question, and we're going to get to the studio construction in a bit, but looking back retrospectively and at the time, I'm curious if your feelings changed. When that studio was being built at the expense of about $100,000, was it, do you think, for control, or do you think it was kind of dictated by wanting to have that cocoon atmosphere that most addicts are trying to create, whether or not they realize it?
I think it was vanity. There were other people that had studios in their houses. I can't remember who they were, but John never wanted to be outdone. And he also wanted the cocoon thing, you know? John was changing so much, and maybe he was doing hard drugs long before I knew it. Long before. I don't know. But I think that it really started, you know, later. But, yeah. You know, it's really... It's the control.
That's
you know?
I think it's yeah. Control.
Right. It seems like that's kind of the foundation on the fulcrum points that your relationship was set up. Who has the control in the relationship? At least from a distance, it seems like there was a lot of power and control dynamics within the band and within your relationship, way more so than is healthy.
Well, he could have his studio as far as I was concerned. I didn't care.
Because you were out. At that point, you were kind of there, but not there.
I had just had China.
Well, not quite yet. One thing before then. So November 67, right after Glad to Be Unhappy, the Farewell to the First Golden Era comes out. Back in those days, when they put out a greatest hits record, it's basically playing taps, right?
Right.
But then to stick the knife in even deeper, they fucking call it Farewell to the First Golden Era, which is almost insulting. So what kind of message did you get the vibe from the company, or did you not even care because you were kind of checked out?
Well, look, ABC Dunhill had no idea what would have been good for us and would have been good for them. And what would have been good, because I do know, was for them to say, you know what, why don't you guys take a break? Let us send you back to the Virgin Islands. See if you have fun. See if you can live together, write together, sing together, and if you still want to be together. It would have cost them a lot less money, and it would have been the generous thing to do to us because we were a mess, and we didn't have any material, and all they were saying was, we need more material, we need more material. That's why we ultimately had to go in and renegotiate our deal, but that meant that we owed them an album.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and four-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discograffiti is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discograffiti's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. And moving forward now, every Sunday for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discograffiti's Patreon family, the Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound podcast. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for $1. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad, don't care. Just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member, and it'll be the only place you'll be able to get our upcoming Lou Barlow, Corey Hansen, Mark Robinson, Will Hart comp, Metal Machine Muzak, as well as the triple album rock opera El Farmony I created with Joe Kennedy, and the ability to purchase one-off Patreon episodes. That's it. Back to the show. Before we get to the record, your beautiful daughter, China Gilliam Phillips, is born February.
No, it's Gilliam China Phillips. I have to keep reminding her of that.
Okay, well, that's a day that obviously changed your life. And she's Aquarius just like me, so she must be a hell of a kid.
She is an absolute wonder.
Yeah.
She's great.
So that's obviously a turning point for you. Unfortunately, at this time, from what I believe, John is seeing Mia Farrow behind your back. Is that what's going on?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a sack of shit.
Yeah. I was just thrilled. They both were just so good at concealing it. And we were spending time together, the three of us. We were going out to Joshua Tree and she was playing Bacatel. What's his name?
Bacatel.
Pachelbel, Pachelbel in D.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I had no idea what was going on. It never occurred to me that they were having an affair. And then I did realize that they were having an affair since they left me with an 8-week-old baby or a 2-week-old baby in the hotel room. And Mia said, oh, we should go out and see the sunset, John. And he said, that's a good idea. We'll be right back. And they came back at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I said, you know what? Something's going on here.
Up until now, the back and forth seems, I guess, feasible, but this feels different because you just had a child And it's so blatantly rude. So I don't understand. It feels like the intention or the spirit behind it changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And then a couple of weeks later, there was some magazine, some rag. It wasn't the National Enquirer. It wasn't the Star. It was something else, something of the world. Or I don't know. But on the front page, it said, Mamma Mia.
Oh, God.
And it was so embarrassing and so rude.
Look, not that you didn't dish it out to him, because you certainly did, but
yeah,
my heart goes out to you for that, specifically circumstantially.
Yeah, well, my heart stood still.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because I was in love with John. It was really because I was so embarrassed by the revelation that they had been seeing each other a long time. Well, there you go.
You were on to better, more nourishing relationships after that.
I was.
Yeah. May 1968, the Papas and the Mamas.
Before that, it was supposed to be called Springboard. That's what it was initially reported as being titled, and then it shifted to Papas and Mamas.
So here's what John said about it. There were only a few bulbs lit in the chandelier by the time the Papas and the Mamas came out in the middle of 68. The album came off like a melancholic meditation on a life of insulated unreality, fame, money, and drugs. I think that pretty much sums it up. It's a dark record. Plus, there's a muted aspect to the quality of the studio, because the studio that you built, or that you had built in your home, which is the father or mother of two of the greatest albums of all time that happened to be, or three of the greatest albums of all time, that happened to be three of the most solipsistic, looking into a hall of mirrors type records that have ever been released. So it's like there was something in the air at 783, like a dark night of the soul. And Papas and Mamas set that ball rolling. That ball rolled into Wolfgang. That ball rolled into There's a Riot Going On. And I think then the ball was silenced, perhaps.
Hey, how big was that studio, Michelle? How big was the room?
Not very big.
Like 12 by 12, something like that?
Yeah, maybe a little bigger than that.
Let me describe what I believe was the situation. It was an 8-track studio. The entrance was behind the concealed panel in the wall, right?
Yeah.
And all of the actual construction had to be done surreptitiously because of building code regulations. So it was all done at night, right?
Yeah.
For the sessions, Cass and Denny would arrive for drinks and hang out until early evening. Then the musicians would arrive so you could begin by about 9 or 10. And by the way, this is taken from John, so I want you to correct what is inflated or what have you. Then the booze and drugs came out by midnight, and by 2 or 3 a.m., the separation from reality among the users would take hold. And then the sessions would then trail off as everybody fell into a stupor. That's his recollection.
Well, I'm sure that the booze started earlier than 10.
Does that sound accurate?
I think it did have to be kind of layered. People couldn't all arrive at the same time. So, I mean, I was now 8 months pregnant or something. Is that about right, Richard?
Yeah, at least for the, because you recorded in January. I mean, you recorded up through.
I had China in February.
Richard, were they still recording after she had China? I think they were, right?
I think a little, just a very little bit, finishing up, you know.
So yeah, I'm guessing, Michelle, you weren't engaging in any of the debauchery.
No. Yeah. I would fall asleep, and then John would come and get me like at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, you know, come and put this part on. And I'd say, I don't want to put a part on right now. He'd say, we can do it in 10 minutes. And so I'd get up and I'd be furious because I had to get up with the baby all night long. And it was not a happy time.
You know what's interesting about that is the story is the flip side of the writing of California Dreamin'. It's like the dark underbelly of the same situation.
Yeah.
You know, you were thrilled to be woken up in 63, 64.
I just know that when he started writing a song called Ivy.
For the love of Ivy.
The biggest disaster in the whole career of the Mamas and the Papas is this song. They had come to him to write a song for a movie that was going to be released called For the Love of Ivy.
Right.
I forget who was in it. But
Sidney Poitier.
Thank God I never brought it up at dinner the other night.
You don't like that song?
I hate it.
I tell you, it's probably my least favorite Mamas and Papas song.
Oh my God. You know what? It was layer over layer over layer, and it was all done at the studio. It was pointless.
You know what? Let's go through the record in order, because, you know, this is a record that's bigger than the sum of its parts. You know, even the stuff on it that's clearly not as good as what came before, because of the context of the record, this is a record I've heard so many times. If you listen to the whole thing, it has a presence about it, which to me is inviolable no matter its shortcomings. So I want to approach it straight through if we can. Let's start with the Write Somebody to Love. So again, second album in a row, we start with your beautiful isolated a cappella voice before anything happens. So is this sarcastic? It almost feels like a Shirley Temple-ish.
It is Shirley Temple.
No, I know, but performed like her as a grown woman. So I'm wondering, is this...
Well, I think this was a cry for help.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. So
honestly, I think it was. It was just, take me back to being a little girl so that I don't have to deal with this. And the lyric is so sweet. It's begging you to love her. Not a big doll house or a Mickey Mouse, but the one somebody to love. And I was the one who picked that song to do. I took it off a Shirley Temple album, and I said, this is what I want to sing. It's almost like, in my case, it was almost like a defiant song. You know, after he'd made me sing Ivy for a month and a half, I just wanted to sing something so simple and so real and something that a child would say.
And also the kind of pain you must have been experiencing, not just with the dissolution of your marriage and the band, but the strained relationships with your best friends. So sometimes with that kind of pain, I know for me, I can't approach it head on. I would need to adopt a Shirley Temple voice to get through it.
Well, I just listened to it the other day, and I realized how appropriate that was for that moment for me, because I didn't feel that I could depend on anybody. I didn't feel that I was loved. I felt very alone with my new baby, and just really knowing that I had to get out of this relationship with John. And I didn't want to hear another fucking song that he wrote, because he was crazy at this point. And he didn't know a good song from a bad song, and he didn't care. And as I said, ABC Dunhill did not do us any favors. They kept saying, you know, that we had to give him an album. We had to give him an album. And I'd say that there's nothing to write about right now. And I think that this is just a lonely song.
It's a lonely album. Also, you got four people who were so wonderful singing together who were not singing together.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this the first album that you're overdubbing vocals? We're starting around a mic, aren't we? Around one mic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you look at so many groups that are harmony groups specifically, where all of them go wrong, but I mean, you know, the seeds of disintegration had been planted way previous to this, but where all of them go wrong is where they stop doing it around one mic and they start overdubbing and building tracks off the vocals. Because especially with the way that the studio was capturing you guys, it did not have that same sense of airy spaciousness about it, which fit Papas and Mamas to a T, but which also sounded very different and disconnected and dark.
Well, that's where it was, disconnected and dark.
Which leads right into Safe
America. We weren't really a group anymore.
But you were still doing what I would deem vital work. Because let's look at the facts here. Richard, Safe in My Garden, was that the debut single from the record?
Yes.
So that's heavy. You're coming off of Glad to Be Unhappy, and then your debut single from this record is pretty clearly shot through with paranoia, drug abuse, and agoraphobia.
Yeah. That's a great way to do an album.
And, you know, it's, again, incredibly honest. you know, we are the counterculture. We are, or were, just like you. And now we're so disconnected, our parents might not even recognize us. Not you. I think this is more John's perspective. But yeah, it's ballsy and it's vital. It's so incredible that John felt comfortable enough to be open to communicating to his audience that I can't even identify with you guys anymore because I'm so fucked because I'm so isolated. It's a really heavy thing to drop on people. It's no wonder it didn't, you know, it did reach the top 100, but I think it peaked at 53, which I'm surprised it got as far as it did because it was pretty heavy, pretty leaden and weighty, you know, but a great song. And then track three, one of my favorite deep cuts, possibly my favorite deep cut in Mamas and Papas history is Meditation Mama, Transcendental Woman Travels.
I loved it too, by the way. You can't understand one word of what he's saying.
It's like all of his solo stuff, because he had no confidence in his voice when he wasn't enshrouded with your voices.
He was just like kind of in a cloud that was going bump-diddy-bump. You know? I know that that's not describing what I'm trying to say, but actually, at the first time I heard it, I thought it was John and Lou singing it.
I always saw Meditation Mama as a precursor to Wolf King.
Oh, yeah. It sounds very much like Wolf King. But that's because it's mostly John.
Well, it's also because he's mixed his voice as low as he does on Wolf King.
Right.
And then For the Love of Ivy, which is truly a piece of shit.
Thank you.
I don't hate it as much as y'all do. It's interesting to me. It was supposed to be a theme, and I've researched this, and it just fell off the chart. And then, like, Quincy Jones got the gig, and I don't know whatever happened. I don't know if it took John too long to come up with it. It ended up that Quincy Jones got the theme.
And they just told John to go fuck himself. You know, if this is what he had to offer them, it was horrible. So I don't think they had to do anything. I don't think there was any legal, I mean, you know, he was also supposed to do The Man Who Fell to Earth.
He did The Man Who Fell to Earth.
A little bit of it.
I actually like his work on that. But what I don't connect with on this tune is that For the Love of Ivy is kind of a show tune thing. It's kind of a slab of nonsense. But it's contextually on a record that typically cuts straight to the quick self-analytically. So, and this just sounds like nothing. I don't know where the perspective is. Plus, the sound quality on it is so boxy and suffocating. I'm not an engineer by any means, but this sounds like it was run through human feces or something.
Well, yeah, it sounds like an exercise in engineering.
David, I cannot go on too much longer.
You know, it has been 4 hours.
I mean, I'm sitting here crying, and this is not good.
Why isn't it good? I'll cry too if you want. Remember that movie Broadcast News?
That was
Holly Hunter. Is that Holly Hunter?
Yeah, remember when William Hurt goes in and adds the shot of him crying? The whole plot that hinges on news being fake. And so this news reporter.
Whatever happened to William Hurt? I love him.
He kind of became a character actor. All right, now that you're sitting up, talk to me about Dream a Little Dream of Me.
Okay.
Oh, hi. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows a few days earlier than the general populace, which is designed to make you feel even more special than you already are. And now back to our expertly crafted program.
When I went to Mexico City when I was six, we stayed with Fabian Andres, who was a teacher at Mexico City College, where my father was enrolled and ready to start. He was going for his bachelor's degree. And my mother had just died, and he took my sister and I to Mexico City. And we moved in with Fabian Andres while we found an apartment of our own. Fabian lived on the 10th floor of the building on Chapultepec. And I remember this night when there was this huge lightning storm and all the lights were out, all you could see was Fabian at his piano. He had a white baby grand and he was playing while the storm lit up around us. He was playing songs and I said, sing us something that you wrote. And he said, okay. And he sang Dream a Little Dream of Me. I always loved Favion because this is the image I have of him just being illuminated by the storm and him singing and playing Dream a Little Dream of Me. And we all stayed friends. He stayed in Mexico City, teaching at Mexico City College. And during the Mamas and the Papas days, towards the end, we were all getting together for a rehearsal. And my father called and he said, I have some news for you. He says, it's not really good. He said, Favion died on New Year's Eve. And I remember sitting there with John and telling him that Favion had written Dream a Little Dream of Me. And he said, oh, that's such a great song. And so Denny showed up for rehearsal and then Cash showed up for rehearsal. And the next thing we knew, John was saying, okay, I got a song that I want you to sing. And that's how Dream a Little Dream of Me became a Mamas and Papas song. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Ba-da-da, ba-da-da. I said, that's me. John tells this story about Dream a Little Dream of Me. And he says, yeah, you know, I love the Hi-Lo's or the Brothers Four or their version of it. I loved it. I was always very impressed with that. He never once mentioned Favion Andres. He never once mentioned the fact that I had been a friend of Favion Andres when that was a little girl. This is the kind of rewriting history. And as you go on to hear things that John has said about me and about other people, you realize that this man lost his mind. He did.
This is a man who, you know, whacked out on cocaine in the mid-70s, used to fax McKenzie and sign every last fax, the king of consciousness.
No.
Yeah. The king of consciousness.
Consciousness. Mm. Look, I'm really sorry that that happened to him. But all of us in the family are having to deal with his stories, you know, things in his book, which I actually talked to an attorney about what he had said in his book. I said, what should I do? And the attorney said, nothing. Let it go. It'll just go away. You don't shine any light on these things because then you'll be asked questions about it. Just say nothing. Well, 20 years later, here it is again. Right out of John's book, it's got to be God's truth, you know, and...
Oh, no, so I'm coming to you because he is the definition, the apotheosis of the unreliable narrator. So I'm coming to you for you to set the record straight because there's no question, you know, who had their head screwed on correctly. So that's why I'm coming to you because I want the tale to be told correctly.
So along those lines, I have a question about Dream a Little Dream. Is it true that Cass despised it as much as has been said, Michelle? Because I've heard that she didn't want to sing it, and that you know, she made fun of it, and then I've heard that she did want to sing it.
No, she did want to sing it.
So I thought.
No one was closer to Cass. Is she your best friend that you've ever had?
I think I went through more with Cass that ended up in a very positive place than any person I've ever known. Is she the best friend that I ever had? It could not possibly be. But we were wonderful friends. And I always felt that I had betrayed her. I felt that she gave me a lot of, you know, she gave me a lot of leeway in spite of the fact that, you know, the Denny thing happened. And she also helped me very much with John, with my relationship with John. But I've had friends. I have some very, very good friends that I love and adore. And I live a really wonderful life. I have really great friends. I have great family. I have a great life. I'm really lucky to have all this. My entire family is dead. But I have friends, really, really good friends. And I live a very happy life. So what can I say? I wish Cass were still here with us.
Mansions. Man, is that a bummer. Do you remember the impetus? Sitting in our mansion guarded by expansion, questioning our motives and our means, wondering why this isn't like the dream. You can't get any more explicit than that. And then there's a coda that's basically a tribute to hedonism. Live your life just as you please. That's basically his sign, or I'm going to go head off into the sunset.
You know, I think that I did not really understand John's demons as well as I do now. I'm not even sure I know them now. But John changed. John changed. I think that John was so wounded as a child, so left alone for everything that he accomplished. There was so much to be sad about. Just something that I was probably too immature to recognize and to help. And I think I do feel responsible in a way for the way things went, because it was like a kaleidoscope of things that were happening and how you felt and who you loved. And, you know, it was very challenging for me as a young woman to understand what was going on. I don't know if we are specific to a kind of natural phenomenon that happens, you know. I don't know if our group, I would love to know what other groups that had men and women in them, I'd love to know what the outcome of their relationships were.
Ask Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever run into Stevie Nicks or any of the...
I don't know Stevie Nicks.
You ever run into any of the people from Fleetwood Mac, and did they ever thank you for rolling out like a template for the band?
I ever met anybody from...
I don't know enough of the history of ABBA, but the ABBA would be similar, right? Because they had a relationship. Was it both couples married or one couple married in ABBA?
Well, they're Swedish.
I know. But they're people.
But I don't think that was infidelity based. I think it was just marriages that split up.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking in terms of how a group devolves. You're right. You don't have all the cross lines there. Well, I think Mansions, I think Too Late. I mean, John, we've talked about this, but he excels at telling the story, right? So Creaky Alley is the prequel, like my book. This is the epilogue. I mean, he's basically telling it, you know, especially in Mansions, because he talks about London. People listening at the time didn't know that exactly, unless they were really attuned to what was happening with John and Michelle and Cass and Denny. But there's a lot of autobiography on this album. Between Mansions and Too Late.
I think that John was trying to reach that audience.
Right.
It was very indulgent. As I said, he was writing what he knew.
Yeah.
And some of what he didn't know, though, because look at Gemini Child. I mean, it's kind of funny. I can imagine John looking at Jimi Hendrix on stage at Monterey, and him watching Jimmy is like germinating inside of him, and it comes out as this, which I love this song, but I can see why people would be like, what the fuck? You know, it's just like the association when they did Six Man Band and they've got their... It's interesting watching a band reach so far out of their area of comfort.
Yeah.
I love the song. I think it's... Do you like Gemini Child?
Not really.
No?
It's a tribute to Michelle, though. I think it's a beautiful portrait of her. I mean, I don't like the aping Hendrix, but I love the lyric. And when it turns soft, I think it's a tribute to her. Even in his addled place, as Michelle has told us, he's really losing it here. But there's a wistful kind of tribute to her, I think, here.
And then Nothing's Too Good for My Little Girl, not the best song on the record. Not a bad song, but not the best song.
No, it's a nothing song.
It is kind of a nothing song. But the thing I connect with is I'm the kid who went bad. That line in there, I'm thinking maybe that's why John connected with it as a cover. Because, you know, Ned Wynn, the songwriter.
Yeah, Ned Wynn is the co-writer on it, right?
He was the writer.
Oh, he wrote the song?
Yeah.
He was the one who brought John the big box at Christmas time with all the samples.
And so we promised him a track on the album. I'm just kidding. All right, then Too Late. And I think Too Late is gorgeous. And except for that wispy synth line that runs through the thing, it feels like Wolf King to me.
Yeah.
Some great
work. I haven't done my homework. I should have listened to all this shit.
So when you become a major, you'll be getting access to the ultimate director's cuts of all our sprawling super deep dive episodes. As far as I'm concerned, these super cuts have absolutely everything that was meant to be heard. Plus, you get yours before the lieutenants get theirs. But that ain't it. You also get all our other series, like Discography's Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. Don't worry about it. You're 100% right on the money. Seriously. You need to not know this stuff because these have to be harbingers of bad memories. Yeah. So we're excused from not doing your homework, young lady. Some of the lyrics on this too, in Too Late, it definitely seems to address the end of the band.
It's too late for talking. It's too early for walking.
Oh.
Love and trust have turned to dust, and that was all you had. Okay. Get on your pony and ride.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That get on your pony and ride, I mean, talking about John serving up to Cass, because she says, because I know, and I've tried, you know, and she's almost saying, I'm on my way out.
Also, interestingly, John was really into the idea of the mid-song deconstruction at this point, which is an odd thing to glom onto as a repeating motif. But this one has a great one, a really great mid-song breakdown. And then 12:30, which at this point almost feels like an artifact of a different age because time is moving so fast for you guys.
Well, no, because what he's writing about in 12:30 is what we used to see out the window in the village when we lived in New York was a clock that always said 12:30. I mean, he's going back. It's weird.
I think it's two songs put together. It's I used to live in New York City. Everything there was dark and dirty. That's your Greenwich Village life. And then it's young girls coming to the canyon. This is, you know, Manson-esque with these girls wandering all over the street.
Listen, as I told him, I said, I know young girls are coming to the canyon, John, and I know you fucked them all. Mm. And it was true. That's when I finally realized that he was bitching about my affairs. But he was having an affair with every girl that walked up Lookout Mountain.
The two of you make me want to wear a promise ring, for God's sake. I'm going celibate. To hell with this.
I had a dream last night that an old boyfriend of mine, who I will not mention, made a ring out of tinfoil and put it on my finger. And I said, this doesn't make us married. And he said, it does.
that was your dream last night?
Yeah, this is a dream I had last night.
Yeah, I'm not going to pry into who it was, but does his name rhyme?
I would never tell you who it was, but...
No, I didn't want to know, but does it rhyme with Blorin Blady?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, does it does it rhyme with Black Blickleson?
Stop!
No.
Okay. All right, moving on. Rooms. So what I love about Rooms, it's a blown chandelier bulb song. It's a great tune. It sounds like, you know, yet another fatalistic John song about the end of your relationship, almost like he's a character in a story reading about the end of your relationship.
Yeah, are you saying that he should have started the first verse with the first bulb going out? And then at the end of that verse, the second bulb goes out. And then at the beginning of the second verse, the third bulb goes out. And the fourth bulb.
Wait, how many bulbs? That's how many verses.
Well, I think there were 12, but we can wiggle that one around.
At least I know what we'll be doing when we meet up in New York. I'm definitely glad in bed, there's no question.
Then I miss my cruise. Great.
All right, so we're at the end. The last song is Midnight Voyage, and that's the one where I was right with you. Sorry, my mistake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. On a midnight voyage, one that has no ending. Wow, John.
It almost feels like it's a seafaring goodbye song. And You Like That, Lou, is a perfect capper, obviously.
Yeah. There's also a very, very interesting little piece of footage. We're in the studio and Cass and I are standing at our mics. And Lou says from the booth, Michelle can do anything she wants.
No, she can't.
No, she can't.
That was during Once Was a Time, I thought.
Was it?
Yeah, it's on the Gathering of Flowers. That's right.
That's the only one that I listen to. I love the studio chatter on that one. It's awesome.
So in the tradition of every 60 songs connects to the drugs, you know, is there a double entendre with Midnight Voyage? I'll take you on a little journey. I'll take you on a little trip.
Obviously, if John wrote it and it has those lyrics in it, there is a double entendre.
Double entendre.
Michelle, Is it so weird to you that you're currently being interviewed by one guy who's done acid about 100 times and another guy who has never done it?
Are you talking about Richard?
Yeah.
100 times.
I've done it about 100 times. Maybe
I've done it 0 times. He's done it 100 times.
And you never?
Never.
No. I'm talking about David.
No, I've done it maybe 100 times. I'd say maybe 80 if I had to guess.
Well, I've taken it several times myself, and I think it's a wonderful drug, but I would never buy it today because I wouldn't know what was in it. And anyhow, drugs is not my thing. I don't care. People want to do drugs. They can do drugs, but they're not going to do them with me. And I'm not taking them to the hospital. And, you know, I'm not going to be injecting them with Narcan, just so everyone knows.
All right. So here's my thing about the Papas and Mamas, okay? The self-lacerating honesty of the record is pummeling at all times to me when listening to this. That's never worn off, especially in relation to the rest of your catalog. It's so detached, cut off, and numbed out. And oddly, there's a fatalism about it, as if John always secretly knew that it would end this way in total disarray. Which, of course, to music nerds like me, it makes it incredibly interesting circumstantially because it raises it above the music at face value. Also, the sound of this record, which you recorded at home, is very different from your prior records. Like I said before, that spaciousness is just gone. It sounds closeted and muted, which is a perfect reflection of the music. But I give this 5 stars. I fucking hate For the Love of Ivy. And there's a couple other songs that I don't think are as strong. But ultimately, as a record, boom. I love it. 5 stars.
So I love it, but it's brooding and it's dark. And it's a record that has had to grow on me. I think it is so introspective. I think it's so intelligent, but I think you can't get away from the sadness, and Michelle's walked us through some of that tonight. I also think that Cass is way on her way out on this album. I mean, she's there, you know, she hasn't recorded her first album yet, but she has left them psychologically, a lot of which is because of what happened in England and, you know, the whole group. So it feels fragmented, you know, the line from 1230. Images light here fragmented, but I give it 4 3/4 because it's the Mamas and the Papas and I love it.
I give it 3.
Okay. That's fair. I understand.
And totally understandable given what you told us. I mean, it's dark and sad and you
I'm surprised you give it 3, but I think it's a great record. I really do. And you guys had two more singles left in you in the 60s. For the Love of Ivy, strangely, and Do You Want to Dance, for whatever reason, because that was years old. They both barely made the top 100. You guys were done. In early 69, the last bulb in your chandelier finally went out. March 69, John begins recording his solo album, which of course takes forever, and comes out over a year later. For you and John, it was a quadruple whammy of change. Tell me if I'm incorrect here. Number one, in January 1969, you and John split. You go to Malibu with China. Two, before spring 69, the Mamas and Papas, after 3.5 years and 4 gold albums, officially disband. But of course, you still owe Don Hill one more record, but more on that soon. Number three, the two of you now begin having physical altercations, which didn't happen before. Correct me if I'm wrong there, please.
I will not discuss physical altercations.
Got it. Okay. With all due respect, moving on. And in May 69, you guys got divorced. John says he filed...
It wasn't final until 71, but yes, that's when we started divorce proceedings.
Okay. So please correct this story, because I know that it's not true. What John wrote in his book is that when your divorce was finalized, that you fainted, and when you came to... You threw down the gauntlet, begged him for a reconciliation to get married again immediately. I mean, I read that and I was like, there is no fucking way that that happened. That is such a reach.
Wait, it's actually in John's book.
That's in John's book.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was never able to get through John's book because it just was so disturbing and it was so stupid and so made up. And it was like Alice in Wonderland.
I remember I met Jack Nicholson and I asked him if he had read Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, which I love. But he said, I don't read fiction.
Yeah. Well, he's right. He's right.
Chris and Bruce and sister Sandy Dedrick and younger sister Ellen joined in 1968. Never seemed as simple as they were because of the music. Music was as soft and breezy as and antithetical to the times as it implies. Vocal parts swoop in and out and double back on one another. Dances over and around acoustic guitars in the mix. There's a harpsichord, bongo, tambourine, light bossa nova flavorings, folk, and even touches that told you these kids knew something about jazz.
Jazz.
We got jazz.
So I want to touch on this only because this is the first thing where John is stepping off or away from the Mamas and Papas and immediately fucking face plants in the worst way. So he's had like the Midas touch now for years. Nothing has gone wrong. Then immediately out of the gate, he takes on Myra Breckinridge, which Time magazine called about as funny as a child molester. also in the same review that the film is so tasteless, it represents some sort of nadir in the history of American cinema. It was one of the biggest box office failures in history. And so John's luck had changed. This was right out of the gate. And then you begin an acting career. In 1969, you were in a film called Saturation 70.
That never became a film.
But you acted, right?
Well, I sat in a supermarket in a space suit.
That sounds like acting to me.
That was the Tony Faust movie?
Yeah, right. So you're with Nudie Cohn, Anita Pallenberg, Brian Jones's son, Julian.
Yeah. That never, ever was made. I tried to shoot a couple of scenes, and I think they ran out of money, actually, is what I think happened.
Your question, Dave, is if it was this the point at which she wanted to make a change and move towards acting versus recording music?
I think specifically what I'm asking is, did you think that music at this point was in your rear view, that you were done with it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, so you weren't interested in a solo career. It was done.
Absolutely.
Interesting. I find that so interesting. You clearly had more things to say later on, and also clearly are even now in very fine voice. It's just interesting that that was it.
I didn't have any interest in singing solo, and the group was over, and a lot of people in the industry were saying, you should become an actress because you can do well as an actress. And I started thinking about that, and I thought that would be fun. So that's what I started doing, or that's what I wanted to do. And I started to see Jack Nicholson, and he said, you know what you should do, Michelle? You should join every acting class you can get into in Los Angeles and learn the trade. Like, you learned how to sing, you can learn how to act, and you can be confident. And he said, I think you would be a great actress. You should do it.
I want to move the conversation into the last movie, because there's a question that I want to ask that I think is fair. I don't want to talk about Dennis, okay? Mainly because you don't want to talk about Dennis, and I respect you, okay? but really, I'm serious. What I do want to know, though, is you've lived a hell of a life. It's been exciting nonstop, right? And it's been messy, like all lives that are well-lived, like a bon vivant. So why specifically don't you want to talk about just Dennis Hopper? What is it about? I don't want to talk about him. I want to talk about why you don't want to talk about him.
You want me to talk about Dennis Hopper and why I don't want to talk about Dennis Hopper?
So you've had a number of relationships with all kinds of people who have been prominent, but there's one that you don't talk about. And I'm just wondering if was it an agreement that you made or something like that, where we don't talk about it?
You know what? I don't talk about it. And I don't talk about him. And it's not because of any agreements. I just do not talk about him.
That's fair.
That satisfy you?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
That must be very satisfying.
Well, I mean, I was scared. I was terrified. Is that what you mean?
That's the end of that topic.
No problem. No problem at all. So you did Dillinger in 73, and that seems to me like maybe you consider that to be your first real coming out as an actress, right?
Yes, I do. And I was also nominated for a Golden Globe.
Yeah. And when you look at your credits, your acting career is not some sideline. And it makes me think of your entry into the music scene, where it's like, oh, I'll just try a couple things. And then all of a sudden, your list of credits, it's just endless.
You know, I was in the Mamas and the Papas for 3 years at best. And I was in mainly television and films for 25 years. So it's very strange. You know, I've had such an odd career. Some people know me from the Mamas and the Papas. Other people know me from Knots Landing. Other people know me for other shows that I've done with Aaron Spelling. And other people know me from Valentino. You know, it's weird.
Let's stop and talk about Valentino for a second. Actually, one of our most esteemed Patreon members, Adam Gottschalk, he really wanted to know more about your experience working with Ken Russell. And actually, I was friends with Ken toward the end of his life.
I love Ken.
He's a character. I loved him from the second I saw him. We locked eyes across the room at a film festival in Oldenburg, Germany, and he immediately came right over to me and invited me to go into his limo. And we just started hanging out the entire festival.
Yeah, that's the kind of guy he was, you know.
My immediate impression of him was, this is a kid in an adult's body.
Yeah, and you should have seen him with Nureyev. Oh my God. You know, Nureyev was so unlikable and so insecure because he didn't know how to speak English. He was so poorly cast. I mean, it wasn't Nureyev's fault, really. It was Ken Russell's fault. because you don't cast a straight Italian character and cast him as a gay Russian lover. It was absurd.
That was his whole thing, though, was pure absurdity, but in a high art context, which always made him such a mystery to me.
Well, he thought that that mystique from the ballet stage would translate into a movie star, mm-hmm. which I'm sorry, it doesn't. People have to understand what you're saying. He was practically speaking in Russian the entire time. He was a pain in the ass from day one. He was a slapper. You know, he would slap people across the face and he would slap people.
Slap you?
Eventually.
And she slapped him, didn't you?
After several weeks, we shot for 6 months.
Wow.
The good old days of Hollywood. And we were in London at Elstree Studios, and he was famous for slapping people. And I came down, I just come down out of wardrobe and hair and makeup, and I go to my chair, which is right next to Rudolph's, and I sit down, and Rudolph is having a big fight with Ken. And he's saying, I will not say these stupid lines. I will not do these stupid things. I hate this script. I hate this. And Ken is saying, but Rudolph, this is the scene we're shooting today, this morning. I will not do it. I hate it. So I'm sitting there and I make the biggest mistake of my career. I lean over to Nureyev and I said, Rudy, is there something you'd rather say than those words? And he turned around to me in this very menacing style. And he slapped my hands that were very daintily on my knees. He slapped my hands and he says, this is none of your fucking business. So at that point, Ken is just looking at me and Rudolph got up and put his back to me and his ass is right in front of me. So I take off and I slap his ass as hard as I can. He scurries across the stage and he says, you little cunt.
That is the most surreal image, thinking of a set full of people slapping each other. You consider that one of the worst experiences you've had? Was that the single worst experience you've had?
Right up there.
It's interesting. You have 4 albums, but you have an endless list of acting credits. Do you see yourself more as an actress or as a singer, or do you not even give a shit about labels or designations?
I have to say that the most fun that I've had is acting. I think I get more accolades for being a mama and the papa. You know, people admire my whole mamas and papas thing. But I'm telling you, when you get on a series and you're on a series for 6 years that gets 20 million people a week watching them. I mean, I laugh so much when I see that streamers are getting 4 million people a week. It's like... You cannot go out without your sunglasses and your hat when you are on a show like Knots Landing.
And here's my final question, okay? Because this will bring us to People Like Us, and I don't think we'll be able to get through that one tonight. The People Like Us sessions, John says that was the final time that you and he made love while on LSD. Myth or truth? Believe the junkie, don't believe
his dreams. Jesus Christ.
I figured as much.
And you know what? It's hard to fight an imagination like John Phelps's imagination. It really is hard to just keep saying, no, that didn't happen. No, that didn't happen. Because people eventually are going to say, well, what did happen?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. But that didn't happen.
Well, look, I would believe you 100 times out of 100 over John. So that's why I'm asking you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. John and I never, never reconnected. When I left there in 1969, John and I did not reconnect. Although China and John, I really felt that they deserved to have a relationship. They were very close. I would take her over there. They would write songs together when she was 4 years old. I thought, you know, this is odd, but he's teaching her how to write songs. This is a very good thing. But I never left her overnight, and I would go back and get her. But John and I never reconnected. I had no interest in reconnecting with John. I wanted him to have a relationship with China, which he desperately wanted. And that's what he got. And no more.
Well, it's interesting then that the guy who wrote the book, Papa John, was basically the same guy in the 60s, carrying out the same bullshit power and control moves on, you know, a woman who was had now fully matured and was out of the relationship and had completely moved on with her life. You know, the dynamics that were a foundation of your relationship when you guys really were kids are still governing his authorial style in his book. He hasn't matured as a person to be able to see, oh, that was me then. He's carrying on the same stuff that dragged right. him through the 60s.
Right, right. Well, he started to kind of fantasize about things. I would say around 68, 69, 70. I started to see this pattern where weird stuff was happening. And that's when I knew that he was about 71, 72. I was sure that he was doing hard drugs. And that's when he was with Genevieve. And that all came from the movie that she had done, that she was very good in.
Joanna.
Yeah. She did Joanna. He fell in love with her. And I was on my knees praising her. Thank you, God. Because it just took the pressure off of me. She was the happiest woman I've ever known to be with John. She adored him. And I encouraged that relationship to the nth degree because she took so much pressure off of me. And she genuinely was madly in love with John.
It feels like a similar thing as David Crosby and Jan Crosby, except without the happy ending, really. David Crosby and Jan, I mean, they got clean and they wound up having what, by all accounts, you know, a nice final act. But it sounds like the experience of Jen staying with John for all that time, it didn't sound like it was a good experience for her.
Well, she came into the relationship already doing heroin, and Michael Sarn and that whole group of people who came in from London were all what they call skin popping.
Right.
And I actually did not believe it. I said, John would never do that. Never. And they said, well, he is. And then when they went to New York, they left a house in Malibu open with all their belongings in it, and they never came back to it. It burned down. I rescued the Grammy that was on the mantle because I went over there and I walked in the door and, you know, it was practically still smoldering. And I saw the Grammy sitting there. So I said, well, I'll take this.
Perfect ending point. That was a poetic closing image. And we're right at people like us. So when we pick back up, it'll be 71. We'll do People Like Us, Wolf King, and Your Record. Then we're done.
Okay, good.
And you'll know about New York within a couple days or so?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a free meal in it for you, even if you don't like me.
I do like you, David. I really do.
Thank you. I really, really have a lot of respect for you. Everything you've been through, everything you've weathered, and to have come out on the other end, such a lovely person inside and out, you lucked out. Everything, all the circumstances, having the right dad, just you're a class act all the way, seriously.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. I appreciate that. You know, it's hard to be really candid about so many disturbing things mm-hmm. in your life. And you've made me feel that I can do that. And I am very grateful to you for giving me that opportunity to talk without feeling like I'm afraid of what I'm saying.
Thank you for that.
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned because next week we've got part 5 of Michelle Phillips' The Interview of a Lifetime, in which binding contracts force ex-lovers and old friends together for an album which to this day makes Michelle practically sick to recall. A heartfelt discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Michelle Phillips, Richard Campbell, Fernando Perdomo, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the greatest music ever made from the 1960s is to leap headfirst into my 12-hour interview with Jules Alexander and Terry Kirkman, the two founding members of Monterey Pop opening act The Association. That's episodes 110 to 113. Vashti Bunyan rating her entire catalog. That's 103 and 104. Os Mutantes' Sergio Diaz on the early days of the band, that's 86 and 87. Burt Summer, 83 and 84. A tribute to David Crosby, that's 77 and 78. Lou Barlow rates the Zombies, that's 59 and 60. Bob Forrest on the band, that's 25 and 27. Monkees manager Andrew Sandoval rating the Monkees, that's 22 and 23. The Bee Gees' Psychedelic Beginnings, that's episode 10. And Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. Join us during the upcoming week. This Sunday, you can expect another deliriously sociopathic entry of Rudy Fishman's Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. These are real people with talent and a burning fire deep inside, just like you and I. Get to know your new music-obsessed friends. Then on Monday, our Patreon major tier gets their super extended Ultimate Director's Cut. And then on Wednesday, the Lieutenant tier gets their extended cut. And then the rest of the hoi polloi get theirs. So, of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, April 19th, we're coming at you with Michelle Phillips' The Interview of a Lifetime, Part 5. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography!
Osiris.